This is the Fathering Project podcast, Figuring It Out Together, where we tackle many challenges facing dads and father figures and explore fathering across all ages, from newborns to toddlers, school age and teenagers. We speak with experts in their fields to help you navigate solutions and positive outcomes for each stage of your fathering journey. Let's figure it out together. Hello and welcome to the Fathering Project podcast. Cathy Gapayah here, and tonight we are very pleased to be joined once again by the one and only Maggie Dent. She's here to talk about the exciting release of her new book, Parental as Anything. Commonly known as the Queen of Common Sense, Maggie Dent has become one of Australia's favourite parenting authors and educators. She has a particular interest in the early years, adolescence and resilience, and is an undisputed boy champion. Maggie's experience includes teaching, counselling and working in palliative care, funeral services and suicide prevention. She's an advocate for the healthy, common sense raising of children in order to strengthen families and communities. She's a passionate, positive voice for children of all ages. Author of 7 books, including her best-selling 2018 book, Mothering Our Boys, and her 2020 release, From Boys to Men, and of course, her most recent book, which hit the bookshelves last week, Parental as Anything. Maggie, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us again tonight.
Hi, Cathy. It's really good to be back. You know how much I believe in the work the Fathering Project does, and so I'm right here, boots and all. Might be UGG boots, but I've got them on.
Fantastic, yes. Now, before we get started, Maggie, I'm sure remember that it's traditional that we ask our guests what you're cooking for dinner tonight. So what's on the menu tonight?
Oh, look, it's a traditional oldie goldie. We're just having a good old roast chook with roast veggies and cauliflower cheese and lots of broccolini and Brussels sprouts. So it's just a lovely cup-filling meal tonight.
Brilliant. Love Brussels sprouts. Not many people love Brussels sprouts. I know. That's fabulous. Yeah, I think we're having lasagna and salad. So, not as complex as yours, but yeah, it'll be good. Friday night dinner, easy Friday night dinner. Maggie, congratulations on the release of your new book. Now, it's packed with so much fabulous advice for parents raising children of all ages, from toddlers to tweens. What led you to write this book?
Such an interesting version of this, because the podcast now is going into its, I think it's the fourth season. And it was in response to us asking parents, what are the common dilemmas that you're struggling with? And let us shine some light onto it. So when ABC Books said, look, I think there should be a book, I was a bit like, I don't know, really? And then I remembered that quite often I listen to a podcast and I go, wow, that's great. And then forget what the that's great bit was. So what it was when I started to write it and use those transcripts, I thought, wow, that's gold. Yeah, no wonder we've put it back into a book form. And apparently I've already had some parents tell me it's just next to their side of the bed so they can dive in. If they've had some challenge during the day, dive into that bit and then just leave it. So in other words, it's got the golden nuggets. And I think that's really what parents want. We haven't got time to scroll for hours, but not necessarily even got time to read my books, which is probably why I sell so many audio books. So that's the reason. It's to give us that opportunity to dive into something that has got, credible information, but with my kind of crazy common sense over the top, reassuring you there's no perfect and good enough's good enough.
I think this one has to be one of my favourite to date. It has so much information for almost all parents and with really practical and easy to follow advice.
I wish we had something like it should be.
I wish we had something like this sooner. Now let's start with chapter one. You talk about raising rooster and lamb children. This is such an interesting analogy. Can you explain a little more about this and what are the key differences?
So Cathy, you can obviously tell I'm a farmer's daughter. And it was interesting when I was talking to Dr. Stuart Shanker from America around the chapter around self-regulation. He was absolutely fascinated with the farmyard kind of metaphor. But essentially, and we didn't really understand it for a long time, is that we actually land with a temperament. And that temperament comes on our DNA. So it would have come from some significant person in our ancestry, maybe mum or dad. And you'll tend to land somewhere on it. And then at one end, we have the roosters who land with enormous amounts of energy. They have a heightened sense of their own importance. They want to win at all costs. They don't want to share. They love challenge. They love excitement. And they don't like sleeping. And really, they are really hard to parent, really hard. And you look like a lousy parent so often with a rooster child. Whereas your lamb, they turn up and they're just sweet, thoughtful. They have empathy. They like sleeping. One of my girlfriend's little boys used to take himself off for a nap when he was tired. Like, what? And so what we need is kind of to make sure there's some rooster in the lamb and some lamb in the rooster, Katie, because we need our roosters to have empathy down the track and to be able to see that their actions impact others. And we do need our lambs to be able to grow in courage and assertiveness. So when a parent says to me, oh, I think I've got a rooster lamb, I say, that's great. So your job is a little bit less involved than those who have them right at either end of that temperament spectrum.
I love how you say rooster children have a PhD in pester power, especially at the shops. I'm sure many parents can relate to this one.
And they really also, it's really interesting. You'll know if you've got a, you know, obviously that I think they poo more and shout louder. They argue before they're verbal. They really can push your buttons. But also if you work with them in a certain way and respect the fact that they've turned up with this heightened sense of importance, you can actually have an ally with them rather than that power struggle. So a really good tip, and it's one of the ones I cover in the book, is every now and then check in with them how they would solve the problem that's going on right now. Ask them for their feedback about what we can do right now. And also if you can give them one special job that the lamb won't even notice if you've got a lamb next. So they're the only child that gets the letter out of the letterbox, or they're the only child that does one little chore, because that feeds that hunger to be seen to be more important, and it really hasn't influenced anything else around the house. So it's the way they perceive the world. And I am going to say that when you parent those kind of and build out that compassion, often you need to parent them less as adolescents, because they've learned to make their own choices and to absolutely deal with the consequences. Whereas you might find as a lamb child, and even one of my lambs, you know, in that year you go to school camps, I think it's year six, he really didn't want to go, you know, and I had to lovingly nudge him out the door because he just wanted to stay home. You pick my subjects. No, this is what you need to be doing. So, you know, it's a challenge for us, but to have a light shone on it to say, hang on a minute, I've got to work with the temperament that is in my child, help them to grow into being more capable with whatever it is that they haven't quite turned up with.
Yes, very accurate, actually, the lambs and the roosters, and I love that analogy. So as children get older and head towards their tween years, what are some things we can do to help support and parent them the best we can, depending on whether they're a rooster or a lamb child?
I think the key aspect of our children growing and in primary years, and it really links around to, you know, the issue of resilience, is we've constantly, and I really encourage co-parents to have a chat at the beginning of the year, like, you know, clicks, Christmas is gone, it's January. Okay, so what new life skills and what new capacities can I build in my child this year? And to really think, okay, it's a conscious choice. I think they're ready, you know, a toddler may be ready to make their own snack. You know, can they dress themselves? As they get into the primary years, you know, can they pack their own lunchbox? Can they carry their backpack to the classroom? Can they walk home from school with a group of students? So we've got to look at that capacity building, because it's scary for us as parents. We want to keep them safe, but we know that's not good down the track. And I had a really interesting experience once with one of my boys' mates, and they were all playing around somewhere around my house in back in the Albany days. And I think they were around 8.5, 9, and I heard my chainsaw start up in the garage. I can tell you, I flew down the stairs to my garage like you would not believe. And here's this boy with goggles on. He's got gloves on his hand and he's got my chainsaw going. And I've got, wah, 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 wah. He turned it off and said, gee, Maggie, this chainsaw is really filthy. So I've cleaned it up and I've sharpened it. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, every time you drive up the driveway, there's a branch that scrapes your car. So I'm just going to go out and cut it off. Now, and I really recognized his dad has taught him how to use power tools and lawn mowers. He actually mows the elderly people's lawns in the street and had been doing it for some time. And I must admit, like, it did push my buttons and go, gosh, my boys are hopeless. I don't even think they can change, you know, a light bulb. So I think we really have to question ourselves is how can I build some more of those things before they become the tween who doesn't take any notice of us and doesn't think we can teach them anything. And I think that's a challenge, because when I talk to teenagers, particularly teenage boys, they say, my parents don't have to teach me anything. It's all on YouTube. And I might say, well, what happens if you lose your phone or your phone's dead? How do you find out that key information? And they look, that's a bit tricky. So we've got to get a buy-in for the Rooster children that they do need to be able to learn things. And every now and then we've got to encourage those lambs to grow bravery around the things they're not naturally as brave with. And I think that's a really important attribute as we work forward. And also make sure we're not doing it in a gender specific way. You know, I really think, I mean, I'm a country girl, I'm a farm girl, and you know, we were taught to mow the lawns just as much as our brothers were. And I think that's another thing in this, we're building authentic capacity that will build their sense of confidence that they can take forward into those adolescent years.
And do you think that, interesting you mentioned the gender divide there, do you think that there are more roosters who are of one gender and lambs who are of the other gender, or evenly split?
No, it's pretty evenly split. And I, because I'm a classic rooster, and I really was hard work for my poor mum. But what also is interesting is if you're a rooster parent and you have a lamb child, gee, it frustrates you because you just kind of want to shake some rooster into them, you know. And if it's the other way around, if you've got the rooster child and you're the lamb parent, wow, that can be really challenging. So we really have to at times talk to our kids about temperament and the tendency for us to, you know, make sure that the choices we make are respectful of others who don't have the same temperament, who aren't the same gender, who are of a different culture, who are a different age. So I think it's our conversations in homes. We need to bring in much earlier around things like consent and respect, so that our kids can learn that their actions can impact others.
Yes, definitely, they so can. It's no secret that raising children in the 21st century has made parenting just that little bit more confusing. So for our children also, they generally seem to be experiencing more anxiety than usual, especially with the digital world that they live in, as well as the pandemic we're all currently living through. What do we need to know about supporting them during these anxious times?
Okay, and I think we've all learned great big lessons since the pandemic arrived, and that is there's some things in life we can't control. We'd all like to control our world because the brain likes predictability. It does like it to be something we can control. And I think as early as possible, we need to help our children recognize there's going to be times they feel anxious because things frighten them. And that's coming from a part of their brain called the amygdala. So our amygdala is wired to keep scanning the world to see what might threaten our sense of survival. And the reason that it does that is to keep us safe and alive. So it's not all bad. And that's the conversation, you know, when I dived in with the chapter with Karen Young, was very much about the fact that we are alive because we have that part of our brain that makes us anxious, because somebody else in caveman days who didn't have it got eaten by the saber-toothed tiger, whereas the other one ran. So it's not all bad. But what our challenge is to work out when we've got that anxiety flooding our body from that cortisol from that amygdala that's threatening us, is it a real threat or an imagined threat? So one of the key things I mentioned in that particular chapter is let's help our kids work out their early warning systems, because you absolutely need to know them. And they're not always the same, you know, and that's, you know, that's one of the things. Some children just get really cold, adults too, really cold chills. And that's one of mine. If something really frightens, I just go freezing cold really quickly. Others get goosebumps. Others get butterflies in the tummy. Some, their mouth gets dry. So we need to help our children work out their early warning signs. And then when they have them, they need to get used to asking themselves three questions. Am I in an unsafe place? Am I with an unsafe person? Am I about to do an unsafe thing? And the challenge for us is that sometimes our children have not got those things going on when they're climbing really high, but mummy or daddy might have them. So our challenge is not to interrupt our children's early warning system. And in the chapter around play, I talked to Gillian McAuliffe, who was the original creator of Bold Park, who has now got the most amazing centre down south called Nature's Atelier. And she said, our children are naturally wired to test their own level of fear if we don't get in the road and mess it up. And that a child will grow, will climb according to their own early warning system. And that they, you watch them sometimes and then their foot goes up and down when they're at a certain level of a climbing frame or up a tree. And the second part to that is we don't put a child up to somewhere because they're four and they should be climbing, right? Because that child's not quite there yet. And I think that's incredibly important. My oldest granddaughter, I'm now blessed with seven. I'm so absolutely lucky. When she was 14 months of age, which is quite young, she threw herself out of her cot with a sleeping bag on, with upper body strength. By 18 months of age, she was climbing quite high up on frames, and I was in our local town with her one day, and she's quite near the top of this big spider frame, and there were, I could hear grown-ups around it saying, someone needs to get that little girl down from there, that's dangerous, right? And I've just gone, well, I think you need to back off because she's got this. Whereas there was a 4.5-year-old little boy who was like two rungs up. And that's our challenge, isn't it? Because we want to hurry our kids up. So one of the things Gillian says is that having our knuckles tight sometimes is really important for our children to be able to grow in their capacity to understand their anxiety when it is life-threatening and when it isn't. And I think that's a really big thing that we keep talking about, becoming braver, and that some things really frighten us. And we can overcome them, but gradually. So minimalizing it or avoiding it are two of the things we naturally do instinctively as parents. And it's not, it's not terribly helpful to help our children who are experiencing anxiety in those ways. So we cover that in great depth.
It's so hard, isn't it, to be standing there and anxious as a parent, as you said, because of course, you know, it's the most cherished thing you have. Yes. And you think they might fall or that something might happen to them, but you've got to give them the opportunity to do their own thing. And as you say, find their own way through life, don't you?
And trust find them a little, the trust them. See, if we say that we can't trust them trusting themselves, then we might be interrupting what Mother Nature's always intended them to grow with.
Yeah, it's amazing. My son, when he was about eight, said to me, Mummy, you're stopping me doing things because you keep saying to me, be careful.
Yes, yes. And yet, you know, that's what a loving parent does, surely. So one of the other things Gillian said, which I think is really important, is she said that when they are about to, say they're climbing a tree, you know, she said to them, sometimes you might check the branch can hold your weight just by putting a foot on it. And she said, when you call out to them to be careful, you interrupt their natural flow of listening to their body. So isn't that, that's gold. When you know that, you might just bite your tongue because you do want to say, be careful. Oh my goodness. One of mine is a serious climber. And I can remember when he was just like my oldest granddaughter. And, we had a tree right outside our kitchen window, and when I could see him, when he started to climb, I had to take my cup of tea up the other end of the house. I could hear if there'd been a blood-curdling scream, and that's the distance you stay away. But I wanted to pull him out of that tree. Every instinct in me as a mother said he needs to come down, but there's the challenge of raising our beautiful children.
It is, isn't it? Trust and have faith that they know what they're doing, even at a very young age, which they generally do, actually, don't they?
Yeah.
Now, I love the term you use about being a lighthouse in another's adolescent life. What's the significance of this and how does this support them?
Oh, look, this is huge. And you'll see this start happening in the tween years as well, Katie. And that's that there's a point where adolescents' brain changes mean that they have these drivers that want them to push back from parents. They start questioning what they say, which is healthy but also tricky, and how they see the world is different. And we know they're biologically wired to want to hang out with friends and take more risk. We know all of that. So what we really want is when they push a parent back, we want another grown up in that space. And they don't push all grown ups back. So the lighthouse figure is a significant adult ally, and that can be a teacher, And I accidentally found out I was a lighthouse for many of my students, even the ones I didn't feel I connected with, you know, that they were watching me and looking at how I was behaving and kind of either copying me or trusting my what I was saying, but not trusting mum and dad who was saying exactly the same thing. So a lighthouse figure is, and the symbolism is really powerful because a lighthouse stands there and shines light. It won't go out and rescue you if you want to crash on the rocks. It shines a light and it will be there. And it's that person who believes in you and holds a space for you. And I think the more we have on that transition into, you know, adulthood, we know that it is one significant, trusted, caring adult, you know, that gets them through. And if it's not a parent, which can be really understandable, then we need to. So I really keep encouraging parents of tweens to make a bit of a pact with all the parents of your teen tweens friends that I'm watching out for them. If you can watch out for mine, and I might whisper something to you that you might pass on. Yep. And I know I did that once with a boy in my house. He was, they just often tween boys don't smell their BO. And I've taught classfuls of them. I had deodorant. And I said to him, look, mate, I'm going to run you home soon, but I need you to put some deodorant on because that's, you know, you're really reeking. And he went, yeah, no worries. But I thought his mum's probably said it a million times, right? So they will listen to some of us, and it's letting that get through that blockage towards what mum and dad are often trying to say to me all the time. That's the gold of lighthouse figures.
Yeah, that resonates very much with us at the Fathering Project, with father figures being lighthouses in other children's lives. And as you say, we say the same thing to all our dads in dads groups, that if you see a child who doesn't have their dad there, or their dad is busy doing something else, or is not listening to their dad, you can scoop them up and you know, be, as you're saying, the shining light for them and guide them in where they need to go.
And it's for girls as well as boys. I'm incredibly grateful. And in my From Boys to Men and Mothering Our Boys, I mention how important those extra men were in my boys' lives, because I wouldn't be able to take them surfing as they got older and older. I took them when they were kind of, they weren't surfing quite such big surf. But those other men, those dads, some weren't even dads, some were teachers who just knew how much they loved surfing. Would often pick them up and take them and bring them home, starving, hungry. And I was just beyond grateful for that opportunity, because this was something that lit their spark. And that's the other thing in the lighthouse. Some lighthouses will be the music teacher or a grandparent who has a passion for woodwork or building things. So it's not always, you know, it's not always, if it's something the lighthouse can recognize and relate to, it's the relatability that is a real key for helping those relationships happen.
So important for every child to have, obviously, parents that are engaged, but also other adults that they can you know, look up to and work with and play with, as you say. Now, one of your passions is also teaching resiliency, which you talk to in your book in chapter 11. What do you believe is the key to raising resilient children so they can begin to grow into resilient tweens, teens, and then obviously adults afterwards?
Well, I think it's very much about looking at the balancing act between the things that nurture and protect children and the things that cause them stress and harm. It's exactly the same for us as grown-ups. And one of the things that happened when we had all the big lockdowns right across the world last year was we had massive increase in stress and the stressors in our life. And many of the things that nurtured and protected us, like going to the gym, catching up with girlfriends or playing sport or taking our children to, you know, the playgrounds, were taken away. So we've got to look at that balancing act as we raise our children, as what nurtures and protects them, not just what, you know, challenges them. Because resilience is about our capacity to adapt to things that are challenging. And having some lessons in that, it's like a PhD in it at the moment. So going back to that thing I said before, Katie, is about building our children's capacity to manage things. And one of the big ones, which sadly we've made a bit of a mess of over the last probably 20 years, and that is we have been over-rewarding children. So the Skinnerism that said you reward children for their good behaviour, you'll get more of it, but punish their bad behaviour. But what we know, all it does is make them hungry for more and more rewards. So we kind of have given far too many stickers. I think some children get stickers for breathing now, don't they? And when we give prizes, you know, for everyone in the running race, it's not okay in terms of that. So what we need our kids to know, there's a couple of key things. The first one is you won't always get what you want in life. You won't always win. There'll be times you will fail, and us growing up still fail. That failing sucks. It doesn't feel good. However, the quicker we can get ourselves up after failing, learn a lesson from the failing, and that is that sometimes we might have to practice more. We might need to try it a different way. or just simply, that's just what happens when we play. So what we're noticing is today's kids are not playing as freely in the natural world, and that's where you can build a lot of resilience. We took away the long monkey bars, Katie, and that's a big problem, because what that taught children, because no child can conquer it the first time they come across it, because it takes time to build the strength in your grip and your shoulder girdle, which also gives you a great posture. So it was a really powerful thing, and you would fail a lot. And there was never a parent there ready to give you a sticker, right? So you weren't getting rewarded from external rewards. You were getting what we call the inner locus of control. Now, you were motivated to conquer that really long thing over a period of time, and you failed a lot. And what motivates us are some really key things that are because we're human, right? We're social beings. The first reason you get motivated is one of your siblings could conquer the monkey bar. You never want a sibling to do something you can't. The second one is a child you don't like can conquer the monkey bar. And the biggest motivator is a child smaller or younger than you. Now, this would happen in a playground with multi-age children. They're already looking around. They do not need a grown-up to get them motivated to want to do that. So can you see one of the challenges of why we have less resilient kids is tender, loving parents have made it so safe in their world that they're not having the experience of learning how to fail and recover. And that's emotional buoyancy. And that's what really we have to marinate our children in. So seeing those moments of mistakes and things and broken windows and all those things and broken bones, they're all opportunities to learn that this happens. It's not because you're bad, you're stupid, you're useless. It's because accidents can happen and we make poor choices, and that we can recover from those and get back up and get going into this strange thing called life.
And that's resilience, really, isn't
that's
it?
Resilience.
And would you say that discipline goes hand in hand with building resilience? You say it's critical not to shame or punish our children. How do we begin to discipline them if they've done wrong? And do you have some strategies from disciplining young children to tweens?
Absolutely. So the key thing is most parents today were parented with parents who believed in Skinnerism. So if you don't punish a child's bad behavior and reward the good, then they're just going to turn out terrible. And now we have enormous amount of research from the science of child development, which shows that that actually doesn't teach your children to make better choices, and that a child intrinsically, particularly, you know, our younger children up to 7 and 8, very rarely is there an absolute intention to make a lousy choice to drive their parents mad, you know, and they can unravel toilet rolls and shove them down toilets. And if you see that through the lens of that bad behavior and chosen by the child, your response to that is going to be quite different, particularly if what happened to you at the same age. But what we now know is that our little ones are biologically wired to use this seeking mechanism in the brain to interpret how the world works. And so unraveling is a physics experiment. The fact they want to put it in the toilet is probably because the toilet roll lives nearby. And that's what happens. They've been seeing you push the button and everything all goes. So you can see how they've made a kind of link there that maybe is not what we want them to do. And so from the younger ones, the very first message is when they make those poor choices, and they might do a crayon picture on your wall instead of on the paper, or on their sister's face with the permanent marker, that's not a bad or naughty child. That's a child exploring the world from a child's perspective without a prefrontal to make a better choice. So our job is to acknowledge Did you do that all by yourself? We want you to take a deep breath first, of course, so you don't react and you respond. And then we say, we don't, that's not where we do drawings, and we don't use those ones, or we don't play in the toilet because there's germs. And the key aspect to inhibit that activity again is get them to help clean it up. And I mean clean it up, to take ages to clean it up, because that means they're not going to do it again because they can remember cleaning up. So that's how we do it with toddlers and younger. But as we're getting older, and sibling stuff, you know, I explore some of the sibling stuff in there because that's one of the biggest challenges, those who've got multi numbers of children, that we need to recognise that not all of us get on all the time as grown-ups with a prefrontal cortex and a mature emotional intelligence. So we need to cut our kids some slack. They're all competing for limited resources as well, right? So sometimes your sibling stuff is actually preparing them to be able to manage difficult people in workplace environments, you know, no matter what it is. So in other words, we don't step in all the time, but we step in if we feel that it's got to a point where it can be potentially bordering on bullying and harmful, and encourage them to work things out themselves. That's really important. Okay, so now we've got a child who is repeatedly, let's give an example, repeatedly might be, say, a boy punching his brother or his sister. Now, we do know that boys use punching as a bit of a game for boys, but when it's done and it hurts, we still want them to stop doing it. So we'd give them a couple of warnings, and we'd step in with what we call swagger, Katie, and that's that even though we're encouraging you to be more connected and tender with your children, they absolutely need us to step in with our parent swagger on. And that's it. We step right in and say, that needs to stop right now. That is not okay in our house. Very clear. But what do we then do if it happens again? We will come through with the swagger and we'll say, next time if that happens, there will be a consequence. And I will remove something. It's usually only rooster kids, it's never lambs. I'm going to remove something that you really enjoy so that you can remember that there's a consequence. Now, you know, quite often they actually get it by then, but you may need to remove their skateboard, or you may need to remove the, you know, whatever it is, their favorite thing for a little while. And maybe a day or two, it starts wiring in the brain that there is a consequence to my behavior. So I think it's a really important thing. That the other really big golden thing, because I talked to Dr. Vanessa Lapointe, the Canadian psychologist who wrote Discipline Without Damage, and she says, this is pure gold. The more connected and loved a child feels, the more likely they're going to do what we want them to do, right? So it's that attachment and relationship. So when we hurt our kids and shame them or push them away, they're less motivated to do what we want them to do after that. And she said, so she talks about the beautiful gift of connect and then direct. So we might go in, it's actually time for them to put that, you know, Dungeons and Dragons game away because dinner's soon. So we might go in and rub the back and go, hey, how long in that level? Okay, just remember after this level, it's time for dinner. Yep, so we rub their back or we ruffle their hair or we give them a tweak on the shoulders. And the same thing can happen if, you know, maybe your daughter's very busy doing a gluing, sticking thing. We go in and we connect by saying, wow, look how you've done those colours on there. You've done a really good job and you've taken ages. Well done. Dinner's nearly ready. So I need you to go wash your hands in a minute. So you can see how we come into their space in tenderness, give the direction. It actually increases the chances of them being compliant. Doesn't guarantee it, but it increases the chances.
And that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? When you think about it, it just makes perfect sense to do that. Maggie,
common
you
sense,
are awesome.
Katie.
We thank you so much. We thank you so much again for joining us tonight and giving our listeners an insight into your amazing new book. Listeners, whatever age your child is, we encourage you to go out and get yourself a copy of this fabulous book. You can purchase it from Maggie's website or Booktopia and Harper and Collins. The link will also be on the Fathering channel. Maggie also has a lot of great parenting resources for all ages on her website, so check that out too. You can also listen to the Parentals Anything podcast for free in the ABC Listening app or find it wherever you get your podcasts. Maggie, once again, congratulations on the book and for joining us tonight. We look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Thank you, Katie. And can I just remind all parents again listening, good enough parents who are imperfect at times, maybe 80-20, can raise awesome kids.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Maggie.
Cheers.
Cheers.